I think this is interesting because I mean, you can point me, maybe Brandon, especially if you're more familiar with the text, you can point me to the place where you think this happens if you think it does. But I'm not sure that, you know, Socrates ever claims that it's history telling us exactly how the future is going to be and how to order our ideal society, which is to say, so you mentioned the Spartan example earlier, right? And there is a real sense in which the ideal city, as they start to define it, starts to look a lot like Sparta and a lot less like Athens, which kind of is surprising to many readers, right? Because Athens is this democratic system. It is, you know, it's very different from Sparta in a lot of ways. And Sparta, as you say, you know, you have this idea of like taking kids at a young age and training them to be exactly what they're meant to be, which is to say warriors, and that, you know, they inevitably then need this base of like slaves and workers, which isn't what the ideal city looks like as they start to define it, but Sparta does this. So that's a kind of worry in the back of people's minds. But I don't think there's anything about Athens' history or Greece's history that directs them toward a particular view of the ideal city. As a matter of fact, history only sort of starts to figure as, like, in a generational sense. So the transition between different regime types for Socrates happens. There's five regime types. I'm just going to outline this briefly, but there's five regime types that he describes: aristocracy, timarchy, oligarchy, democracy, and then tyranny. And the movement between each happens in the span of one generation. So basically, there is this, there's a really hilarious passage at the start of book eight where of the Republic, where basically they try to find this number, this magic number that's supposed to govern when people have sex in the city so that no one of a particular class intermarries with someone of a different class, and that you always guarantee that no one is marrying like their fathers or their mothers or their children, because everyone in the city is held in common. There are no wives and no children of any, there's no familial unit. And so he goes off on this tangent trying to find this precise mathematical, this number that governs marriages. He doesn't say, like, this is part of why I think that there's no universe in which Socrates thinks this is actually true. He's just kind of like throwing this out there for the sake of conversation, and again as a point to the ridiculousness of it all. But there's a number, we don't know if it's months or days or years or whatever, that people have to wait before having sex anyways. And then so eventually the first step away from the perfect city is that someone messes up this number. So the first problem is that someone messes up the number, you have sex with the wrong person, you have a sort of half-breed child between different kinds of soul, and then you have two parents. Then the family unit kind of starts to get reintroduced, which the city is not supposed to have. And then you have parents that are of different dispositions, and the child starts to follow the wrong disposition for their class. And so then you get people that love honor, that's timarchy. Then you get people that, where wealth is the driving factor, that's oligarchy. And then democracy, where you start to get two classes in oligarchy, of the rich and the poor. The poor rise up very much in a kind of proletariat revolution. And then you get tyranny, where one person stands up for, or purports to stand up for the people, and then kind of takes over unitary control of the city. And you've gone from rule by this principle of the good and rule by philosophers, all the way to the opposite, to rule by one single individual and their appetites and dispositions. I don't think that in this description, what's happening is that somehow this is preordained by history, or even preordained at all. I mean, the implication is that this is kind of inevitably going to happen, but at the same time, there's any number, any multitude of ways in which movement between these regimes can happen. And so I think it's a bit of I haven't read the Popper's work, so I may, you know, correct me if I'm mischaracterizing, but I think it's a bit of a hyperbole to suggest that that's what's happening when we define the fall from Kallipolis, it's not exactly like a...
So it is important to note here that when Popper talks about historicism, he lays the blame heavily on the feet of at Hegel and Marx, but then he also lays it at Plato. Not as much on Plato, but a lot more on Hegel and Marx. But he basically says, like, the reason that Hegel makes these types of mistakes is because he takes inspiration from Plato, from an ideal theory of forms, that he could have ideal knowledge, which in reality is not possible. And that is the problem.
It's interesting, though, because, yeah. And in a sense, it's true. Like, in a sense, the criticism stands, I think, that if you're talking about utopia and you are focusing on forms and ideal things, and then you try and pretend as if that's a reflection of the real world, that's where you're going to be in error. Because, you know, the cave example is very clear. Like, nothing that is a form or is the good is the same as what is material. Nothing material can be as good as a form. But that doesn't mean that thinking about those forms is necessarily an evil. It's how you treat it relative to the material world that is the problem.
And I think this is kind of the category error that he's accusing Hegel and then Marx of participating in, is taking that method of trying to understand something in its ideal form and applying it to the material form when that is not meant to be. I just want to read a few lines here because I think that will help inform our discussion a little bit. Also because I think I might have said something that could be misinterpreted quite easily. So in chapter 9 of his book, Popper's distinction between two approaches to social engineering, utopian engineering and piecemeal engineering, of which he favors the latter. Utopian engineering requires a blueprint of the ideal society, in rough outline at least, and determines practical action by considering the best means for realizing the ultimate political aim. So a utopian engineering is, there's a blueprint for an ideal society, and there are practical actions towards getting there, and you have to actually try to achieve it. So he's saying this is very practical. In contrast, piecemeal engineering adopts the method of searching for and fighting against the greatest and most urgent evils of society, rather than searching for and fighting for its greatest ultimate good. The piecemeal engineer aims to improve the current situation of society by gradually fighting against suffering, injustice, and war, and other such social evils whose existence can be established relatively easily. In contrast, utopian engineering is less likely to be supported by the approval and agreement of a great number of people, since it is difficult to judge a blueprint for social engineering on a grand scale. Indeed, since utopian engineers, according to Popper, tend to deny that there are rational methods to determine once and for all what the ideal is, what the best means of its realization are, it follows that any difference of opinion between utopian engineers must therefore lead, in the absence of rational methods, to the use of power instead of reason, to violence. Popper argues that a piecemeal approach, which involves small-scale social experiments, is more effective and realistic than the utopian approach, which is more liable to attempt the reconstruction of society as a whole, very sweeping changes whose practical consequences are hard to calculate owing to our limited experiences. Popper emphasizes the importance of gaining experience through trial and error and compares social engineering to mechanical engineering. He contrasts his criticism of Platonic idealism with Marx's criticism of utopianism, advocating for a piecemeal approach to learn and change our views as we act. So, open society and its enemies, it's really complex. There are tons of footnotes. He engages with, like, 50 different thinkers in, like, at least every chapter. That might be an exaggeration, but it does a whole bunch of legwork trying to figure out what is the philosophical justification for our current ideals of liberal, let's see, let's make sure I get this right, for the current ideals of an open society and liberal democracy. So an open society is a society where people are not expressly forbidden. It's a society that has tolerance, essentially human rights. Like the two are very related. Although these are all oversimplifications for the sake of time. And liberal democracy We won't go into that too much, but that is very different than the democracy that Plato or Socrates, if you prefer, is talking about in the Athenian context. I do want to mention, because one of the things that I am most proud of is that when I was at Vancouver Island University, I got to take a world history course. And for my final paper in that course, I wrote a paper on the Athenian constitution, which and ancient Athens, which was written by Aristotle. And to bring some more credence to my argument, Plato was a person of political ambitions. He wasn't someone who directly participated in Athenian democracy, sitting in the assembly and arguing for his positions, but it is definitely well known that he talked with many prominent politicians and was involved in some of the aspects of governance. One of his students, Aristotle, later came to tutor Alexander the Great and had great influence over basically the whole Greek-speaking world and the creation of that Greek-speaking world. So, and Aristotle writes this Constitution of Athens, in which he details that there is a merchant named Solon who is appointed the mediator between the poor of Athens and the rich of Athens. And what's happening in this situation, and I think it's very important to talk about, is the poor of Athens are having their citizenship revoked due to debts. So the rich are forcing them into situations where they have to take up debts they can't pay. And then when they can't pay those debts, they are taking away their citizenship and making them slaves. And for this reason, the poor residents of Athens are rising up in violent rebellion. And so what Solon does, he does a few things. But the most important thing is he doesn't take either side. He doesn't take the richest side. He doesn't take the poor side. What he does instead is he creates a constitution of Athens. He creates the institution of the assembly. And he says that, and he makes it so that no one can lose their citizenship due to debts. He makes citizenship a right that is passed from, it's an inheritable right, and it cannot be taken away because of any type of economic disadvantage. And that fundamentally changes the city of Athens. What's actually very interesting is that when this new system is established, the system of democracy, Solon is incredibly unpopular because both the poor and the rich hate him, because the rich wanted him to let them keep some people as slaves, and the poor wanted him to take all of the wealth that he believed was that they believed was unjustly taken from them and give it back to the poor. But Solon says in his poetry that he didn't want to take the side of either side, and he didn't want to let either one of them triumph if the triumph wasn't right. He believed that letting either triumph would not be right for the city. And so he created this compromise, the Athenian constitution, which is what leads to democracy. I think that's an interesting tidbit of history, but it also, when it comes to the idea of piecemeal engineering versus utopian engineering, Solon's construction of an Athenian constitution is piecemeal engineering. It's not utopian engineering. The idea of democracy at all, like, Athens would never have existed if some philosopher had created a utopian plan for it and said, this is how things are going to be. It's going to be a great society. It exists because of piecemeal engineering. And maybe I'm way too biased in Popper's favor, but I think he does have a very legitimate point there. That said, I do think that the Republic is amazing. It's something we should read. It's something we should study. It's something we should appreciate. But maybe it's not something that, or something we should be very guarded about when it comes to considering it as a basis for political ideologies and consider its perhaps negative influence or misinterpretation by people like Hegel and Marx, taking the idealist frame and applying it directly to material politics.
Solon is one of the great impartial Greeks in a certain way. If you read Herodotus, he says he's going to tell the tale not only of the Greeks, but the barbarians. Homer says he'll sing the praise of the Achaeans and the Trojans as well. He sees a conflict, and he says, well, if one of these triumphs, and the tension that exists that is needed to keep this situation going would just dissipate, he creates a, he sees a means of maintaining the tension without one collapsing into the other. He sees that, well, if this keeps going on, the rich are just going to take in all of the poor. That would completely, one of the sides is about to win here. We need to maintain this tension in a certain way. And I think in a certain way as well, going back to what I said about utopianism as a kind of sentimental attempt to solve a problem, political projects don't necessarily need to solve problems. They need to address problems. They see a problem, the way that it can go, and they say we need to go another way. Utopian projects might just want one of these sites to win, and that kind of does solve the problem, but at the cost of what I think Solon is seeing, that is the tension set up by the communities. But also to say that, because I mean, it's not like Solon didn't have history to look to as well, but in a certain way, when we think about ourselves, you know, we talk about having like there's a lot of history behind us. We have very bloated historical consciousness. It's easy for us to look to the past and say, okay, well, we don't really learn from the past in the way that we learn something like mathematics. You know, we don't just take something out of its context and say, if we do this, then we'll get the same result. We understand that the reason it had the result it did was because of certain contextual nuances and whatnot. And it's less, when we look to history and learn from it, it's less like acquiring some kind of knowledge, and it's more like an aptitude or a skill. We're learning to do politics as a skill. You know, that comes with all the messiness of having imperfect results or inconclusive results, kind of just leaving things suspended, but like in a better place, or at least it doesn't get any worse. I think Solon does something like that. He leads the Athenian constitution to be improved on. I think I'm not sure exactly where it goes after that, but in any case, he does try to intervene. He doesn't apply a program in that certain sense, I suppose. I suppose I'm trying to address my own idea about utopianism being the solution for something, but
to give you a little bit more information there, what basically happens is, and the Constitution of Athens as written by Aristotle, which was only recovered in the early 1900s, so it's something that wasn't present when Hegel wrote his work. It's something that wasn't present when Marx was dealing with a lot of his stuff, which I think is actually why I think we have so much good work to do, like as people who are interested in academic studies today. Like, there's so much more information that we have at our fingertips that people couldn't have dreamed of when, you know, Marx was writing in his in the library. Like, we have so much available to us, and I think we have an obligation to really dig deep into the literature from a variety of sides so that we can try to create a good solution. But sorry, try to create a more nuanced understanding of the world. What happens is Solon sets this program in place. He as the mediator, he presents this as the solution in the mediation, the idea of the constitution. He gives it to the people, and then he leaves on a ship because this is very unpopular. And so they actually keep the constitution for a few years. But then what happens is the people actually start disliking the constitution. They start disliking all of these rules, and they actually... someone appears who's a tyrant, and the reason he's a tyrant is because he suspends the constitution, and rather than ruling by the rules that were set by Solon, he rules by his own authority and does whatever he wants. What's interesting, though, is that after that tyrant, the people really have enough of tyranny, and they go back to the constitution, and then they do make some more alterations and change things. But it's really interesting in ancient Athens, particularly because now there's an alternative. And I think if you look at other Greek city-states that we don't know anything about, you know, the rich could have devoured the poor. Then the poor have their day. They conquer the rich. Then they become the new ruling class. And this just happens over and over again. Like, the majority of Greek city-states were destroyed by, well, they exist in this kind of like perpetual chaos of fighting between people who were owners and slaves, and people who were external, who were arriving to Greece, people who were internal, who were moving around. So the Constitution, I think, was incredibly unlikely to occur. It didn't occur in the majority of Greek city-states, and I think that because it did occur, it gave Athens significant advantages in terms of political stability that other states didn't have, which is one of the things that contributed to its power.
There's something special about modernity. And in some senses, there is. In some senses, there very much isn't. And so if you look at certain concepts, I mean, you were talking about, like, slavery and warfare and stuff. So war is a good example of something where the traditions that underlie the way we conduct warfare are ancient. A lot of what informs, though we have codified laws and an international system that, of course, never existed previously, a lot of what actually underlies our thinking or our approach to certain aspects of interacting between societies and in societies, some of those ideas are not new, and a lot of them are actually have their foundation in very ancient, you know, projects and what have you. And so to suggest that there is something that we should somehow see ourselves as in a completely new and different time that cannot possibly be informed by history or defined by history, in a sense, is wrong. Like, a lot of what we do is still defined by history, so that's something that I want to point out. And then when it comes to, I thought this was an interesting point about engineering and piecemeal engineering versus utopian engineering. Popper really seems to have a problem with what we call radical reconstructionism. So reconstructionism being this idea that, like, you need to burn everything down and start from scratch, right, in order to create something new. It's the driving force behind a lot of revolutionary movements. I should flag for our audience, there is a difference between revolution and rebellion, for example. So revolution is really you're trying to not only, like, put a different ruler on the throne or you know, depose someone or what have you, it's actually fundamentally restructuring the political structure under which you live. That's what defines revolution, right? And so Popper seems to have a big problem with this, like, idea of radical reconstructionism and rebuilding things from scratch in order to achieve an ideal, which would be the utopian engineering way of going about doing something. But that's not necessarily an argument against using an idea of utopia to inform one's political projects, nor is it necessarily a critique of, like, any one system over another. It's just this idea that, like, yeah, if you're gonna take everything down and start from zero, you're gonna get a lot of problems and you're going to encounter a lot of resistance because people aren't prone to change that quickly and that radically and have it work as a political system. Again, you give the example of Athens. Sometimes it happens where you have a democracy is introduced after a period of oligarchy or tyranny or what have you, and it kind of goes back and forth for a while. You have the Sicilian expedition. It goes, you know, that goes disastrously. It goes back to democracy, away from democracy again. So you get a lot of this turmoil over time. But that just because that can happen, and because there maybe is an element of randomness in the sense that, like, you never know who's going to, like, come and do a great speech and convince a population about something, or who's going to sit on the throne next, that doesn't say anything about again any particular kind of system and what that system might achieve, nor about the idea of using forms and ideals to inform our philosophical thinking and our political thinking, right? So there's a few ideas in here that are kind of entangled that I think might not necessarily be rightly so.
I think this distinction between revolution and rebellion is quite interesting. I wonder how Popper would take that distinction. I mean, I was thinking of also introducing the distinction between power and violence, because it seems like Popper is equating the two things. I mean, again, Hannah Arendt makes this distinction that political power is what you have when you have authority, because authority needs power, right? You resort to political violence precisely because you lack political power, right?
This is a very, like, Kai Nielsen makes this distinction in the literature about, like, terrorism and revolution and whether terrorism is a valid option as a political tool and whatnot. So he makes a similar distinction. I'm not sure how I feel about it, that it's always accurate. But yeah, there's a lot to talk about here. And, you know, I mentioned this to you guys earlier, but my studies recently have really been around philosophy of war and how this works. So I'd be happy to revisit some of these distinctions at a later date and see if that helps to inform our conversation maybe about social change and political change, because I think it's one thing to talk about building the ideal society in thought and whether that translates, and then how we actually get there in practice. I think those are maybe two different discussions.
I do think just recognizing that those are two different discussions will put us in a better place than some people in the past who have chosen not to do that. I think that Hegel's idea of the dialectic, while I have some appreciation for it, is also very, very flawed. I don't want to believe that the only way humanity can progress is through violent conflict, and that that is both a necessary good and the state of nature of all humanity. I think I can appreciate some aspects of that philosophical ideal, but I think he was patently wrong. I don't think that violent conflict is the only way that we can synthesize our differing perspectives. Maybe that was true at some point previous in history. I don't think it was. I think we always have better options. Maybe violence is sometimes necessary, but it should never be the only option that we're left with.
philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Indulge yourself in the cultural and folklore traditions of Italy on Il Sole Italiano every Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. Eravamo ancora fanciulli ogni sera su quel prato. This is Bird Note. What does an owl sound like? For a long time, author and illustrator Becca Rowland thought the answer was simple.
As a kid, an owl made one sound. Like, a cow says moo and an owl says hoo, and, like, that was it. But very few owls actually make that noise. They have such a wide variety of sounds. They sound like a horse.
Like the eastern screech owl.
Or they sound like a kazoo.
That's the long-eared owl.
Or the barn owl, like someone absolutely screaming because they're being murdered. Like, it's a terrible noise.
These owls are among dozens of entries in Becca's new book, Bird Talk: Hilariously Accurate Ways to Identify Birds by the Sounds They Make.
If it sounds like a kettle whistling, it's a snowy owl. If it sounds like someone learning to play a recorder, it's a northern saw-whet owl. In your head, you think, I know what an owl sounds like, and then you learn that you don't. I love learning things that I thought I knew that were wrong.
Learn more about Becca's book, Bird Talk, at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Support for Bird Note is provided by Jim and Birta Fulkener from Seattle, Washington, and generous listeners around the world.